Hello, this is Peter Jacoby for Profiles. If I were to list all the accomplishments and awards that are part of our studio guest's resume, I'd need to spend the full hour doing just that. Suffice to say up front that John Harbison is one of the nation's most respected and versatile composers, that he's among the favorite as recipient of a Pulitzer Prize in 1987 for his cantata, The Flight into Egypt, that he has earned such important recognitions as a MacArthur Fellowship, a Heinz Award for the Arts and Humanities, and the Harvard Arts Medal. John Harbison is not only a composer of merit, but a conductor and teacher and festival organizer. We're in the WFIU studio during a period when he is in residence at Indiana University to meet with composition students, to hear some of his works performed by the New Music Ensemble, and to conduct a chamber orchestra program that also contains music of Harbison along with that of Bach and Haydn. Welcome, John Harbison.
Thank you.
When you take on an assignment such as this visit to Indiana, what are your expectations? I mean, how do you prepare for such an assignment, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, it interests me, obviously, because it's a music school, it's a big school of music, and I still do a lot of teaching, but I teach in an institute of technology where I suppose the profile, the mentality of the student couldn't be more different. We have very skilled musicians at MIT, but we do not have people entering the profession. And it is in no way geared towards those kinds of goals. We know that we're working with people who are what I would call volunteer musicians. They carve out of their otherwise quite demanding schedules, segments of time to really immerse themselves in music. But we're equipping them in another way for a future with music. And so going into a school of music is just a very different atmosphere for me, something that I don't get too many chances to do except in my summer dress at Tanglewood, where that is again yet something else, because Tanglewood is a competitive selection from really music schools, conservatories, and professionally goal-oriented people. So I'm really interested to see how music school works. I want to experience as many of the subsets of that as I can witness while I'm here.
So the MIT students, it's their hobby, music?
I guess you'd say so. They are, I think of them as the future board members, developers of acoustical breakthroughs, computer explorers, citizens of considerable influence and importance. But above all, what I think I'm training there is cultivated listeners who listen at a high level. And if for me they write compositions or sonata movements in the style of Haydn or whatever they do, I feel like I'm training their ears so that if they move to Grand Rapids, that they become the chairman of the board of the symphony, and that symphony plays a lot of my music.
Which is important, isn't it?
Music
is a whole in your own music.
Obviously, I'm kidding around there, but that some sort of enlightened leadership enters the musical field through that route.
Now, to the classical music public, you are first and foremost a composer, and I suspect you rank that activity number one on your set of priorities. But when you go off to do a week at IU or any other school, or when you do the professor thing at MIT, or you conduct or you spend time promoting your music, do you feel that you're shortchanging composition, or do you like the mix?
Well, more and more in recent years, I'm having to really battle to get enough time to compose because I am spread out in these various areas. I don't conduct very much anymore. I actually did conduct professionally early in my life before I taught. But I do find other things really more and more pressing. As you mentioned, you know, leading a festival, being president of the Copeland Fund, which has a lot of, I'd have to say, real decisive issues that have to be worked at right away. Things that can't wait, I have a few too many of them, I think. I am, however, beginning to learn to compose sort of on another track, that is to say, a piece may wait for a while to start, but if I can think about it in the spare moments, just walking from place to place, it's something I've had to learn. I used to have a luxury of really setting lots of time aside, and I don't now.
You can come and go to a composition?
I have to do that, yeah. And I find that as long as I can stay what I call even with it, if I can take enough time to not go out of touch, I can move forward when I get the moment. And it doesn't need to be always now a large-scale moment.
Now, by chance, you're in Bloomington at a time that soprano Dawn Upshaw is coming to give a recital at the IU Auditorium. And her recital includes your Mirabai songs, which she told me initiated your relationship with her. And she says she loves you and she loves your music. And I know that you did another set of songs for her this season.
Indeed. She's really has been from that moment that I met her on the phone. She was calling from a motel, I think, in Nebraska. I was in Los Angeles with the Philharmonic. And ever since then, right on that phone conversation, I knew this was a remarkable person. And she's really been a muse. And this piece, Milos Songs, that she did just only a few weeks ago at the New York Philharmonic, is the piece that of mine that we're doing with the Chamber Orchestra.
Yes.
And we're doing it with three singers covering Dawn's part. Lots of good reasons to do that. It was a piece, once again, where I just, in a way, listened in my head to Dawn and went off in what was, for me, a slightly different direction. And always happens when I work for her. It's now, I'm happy to say, I think the fourth or fifth time I've written a large-scale piece for her.
Hmm. Tell us how you approach the setting of poetry into music. The writing of songs has become one of your specialties.
It has, somewhat to my surprise, because when I started out as a composer, my idea was that I wanted to write operas. And I wrote a very early opera, and it did sort of the things for me compositionally that I wanted to. It opened up lots of gates, but it didn't get produced for 12 years. So that held up my opera career considerably. And so I think at that point, at that juncture, I began getting interested in the writing of songs, which is a very different world. It couldn't be more different from writing opera. It's really the other end of one's compositional vocabulary and skill. But I have gotten, as time goes on, quite immersed in the idea of trying to define a real approach to writing songs, which to me is both exploratory in terms of the language, but also apprehendable to the listener and gets inside in some way what the individual poet is doing. And I think if I prepare enough and I live enough in the world of the poet, it changes my own language in ways that I'm glad to have happen. So I've had some fairly thorough immersions with certain poets, not personally at all, but really just with the work.
Their work.
And usually much of that precedes the actual musical work, and sometimes it then goes on even when I'm not setting their work anymore.
Well, let's take these Milos songs, for instance. What particularly drew you to them, and what were you trying to get into the music?
I read his book, The Captive Mind, when I was still an undergraduate. Of course, a political book about life in Poland under the communists. And I'd not really been aware of him as a poet until the late 70s, when I just was constantly re-struck by how powerful his poetic voice was and is. I didn't think of them as settable for a long time, because they're not the kind of thing that you associate with song settings. They're not about romantic love. They're not particularly scenic or nostalgic. They're, in a sense, about the sweep of history, about the grandeur of events, about how we recover from them, about how we react to things that are bigger than we are. Difficult subjects for songwriting, and I had to kind of adjust or find a way find the kind of poems that seemed to me expressed his vision but were also comprehensible musically. And that took quite a while. And to this day, I would say the four or five Milosz poems that I value most and would read most often, I would not contemplate setting. But I do have a very strong relationship to them. And I hope that some of that comes through in the setting of these shorter poems that I chose in the cycle, which have almost like snapshots of the kind of themes that he deals with on much more of a scale other places. But I do feel that he is uniquely aware of how really ephemeral a single life is in relationship to the tremendous, almost overwhelming events of the last century, which he witnessed up much closer than most of us did. So in other words, I take him as a witness. I try to put myself in his shoes to some extent. So the first poems in Milosz songs, the early ones, are really right up against things that we don't always want to think about. Oppression, the state against the person, one person against another, loss, tremendous displacement of individuals and lives. And then I do finally allow a certain amount of another side of Milosz, which is that in spite of all this, he's really a sensualist and someone who enjoys the world. And that paradox I wanted to make sure becomes part of the cycle as well.
And you have to capture that not only in the totality of the cycle, but in the world of each little song, right?
And each song, to me, always needs to have a world. It needs to be a distinct thing. I'm not interested particularly in the kind of song cycle that strings together and keeps the sound going. I want the song to end, and then I want us to have to start, start over. So the silence between the songs becomes to me a really important adjustment period. In these particularly, because one song will be of such a different subject matter than another, I want the audience to be willing to make sometimes a really global shift.
On a lighter note, but still speaking of songs, you've given us one for inclusion on this program, a favorite of yours, mm-hmm. and certainly of ours here in South Central Indiana at Indiana mm-hmm. University, where Hoagy Carmichael spent some formative years. Stardust, what has drawn you to it?
Well, I started out as a teenager not being sure whether jazz or concert music was going to be my future. I was really serious about jazz in the way that one can become immersed in a world. And I knew the standard jazz songs, of which Stardust, of course, was always one, very early. And I've actually continued to be a jazz player. I've reconstituted my jazz life in recent years. My friends who are honest with me say I still sound very rusty. But I'm ignoring that for the moment and persisting. And at our festival in Wisconsin, we always have a very popular jazz concert as part of the string of concerts we do. And we did one season, I think a few seasons ago, a Hoagy Carmichael feature. We played about 8 or 10 of his songs. And Stardust there's no better popular song, but it interests me obviously tremendously as a composer because of its intricacy, because there's no song I can think of that's as popular as that has as wayward and improvisational a structure. The sense of no phrase of the chorus repeating or doubling back on itself, the kind of thing that popular songs would be expected to do. This has always fascinated me. So one of the things I wanted to do, of course, when I got to Bloomington, is go see the site of the Book Nook.
Yes.
And just really take in an ambience out of which came some of the best American popular songwriting, which has always struck me as not divisible quality-wise from the leader period of Germany.
what version are we going to be
hearing? Well, we're going to hear, this is mostly, I should say very modestly, mostly the pianist in the group. The rhythm section joins at a certain point, but it was just, say, as of two summers ago, the way I was hearing this really.
So it's from your festival.
Yeah, really indestructible song.
So it's Harbison and Company.
Yes, John Schaefer on bass. Yeah, a estimable graduate of the University of Indiana and now the head of the music school at the University of Wisconsin. So that's what you'll hear.
Good. Let's listen to Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust.
Thank you.
We have just heard Stardust, Holger Carmichael's great song, a favorite of our guest in the studio, John Harbison. Your affinity for vocal music has found expression in various forms. The songs which we've spoken of, operas, cantatas, a requiem that you wrote not long ago for Boston. You made headlines, earning a commission from the Metropolitan Opera to set The Great Gatsby into music, for which you also gained critical and public praise. Now, that's a major project, it would seem to me. How did it come about, and how did you go about completing this assignment?
Well, I had been trying to write an opera on Gatsby for many years, and I didn't have any success with the rights. It was a problem actually related to the movie. The rights organization that controlled that material had been unhappy with the movie and with the treatment. And they became, I guess, quite restrictive. And I got a letter. I used to joke with my wife, if there's a letter from James Levine, then you can call me, otherwise don't bother me. One day a letter came from James Levine in the early 90s saying, would I write a piece for the Metropolitan Opera? Mm. And so at that point I said, can you help me with this rights issue? And in fact, two things happened. One, obviously, the participation or possible of the Met was useful. But the other thing was that before the copyright law was rewritten, it was about to run out at that moment. And discovering that was to my advantage because the holders of the rights would preferred to be paid before it ran out. So I was then able to go ahead with that. And I already had made a scenario many years before, I think 1985, the year I wrote the overture, which was sort of a little bit hoping just to get some of the material I've been sketching out out in front of the public. The overture, which actually is in a different form still present in the opera. And so I had many, many thoughts together about that opera before I really fully invested in it. And I used a good deal of the sketch material from the 85 pass at the opera when I wrote it in the mid-90s. And I still, it's interesting, I remember so well that procedure of working on that piece. I really remember which things in the opera are from which of my encounters with the subject matter. And one of the tricky things for me was trying to then, since I was a rather different composer 10 or 15 years later, trying to reconcile slight, you know, differences of approach. But it was for me, as in terms of writing it, a totally joyful experience. I had no resistance in that piece anywhere. Putting it on was not a joyful experience because what I discovered in the course of being with that piece and being with the opera public and particularly the opera production world is that in terms of the way I conceive opera, I'm kind of a fish out of water. For me, opera is a piece of music first, and then it's all the rest of the stuff, the visual and the kind of roles that are sung and the presence or absence of formal arias. None of that is as interesting to me as what I would call a symphonic reality of very large span. And most of the people that I met, with really the notable exception of Mr. Levine, were what I would call visual receivers of opera, who marked the experience of being in the theater with the opera about in terms of movement on the stage and in terms of not being bored by what I call moments of stasis. And I also discovered that everyone in the opera production world has a cure for every problem, and that is to cut. And for me, symphonically conceiving opera, that is a much less effective way of dealing with the difficulty. And I've learned, in being in the opera field, that with older operas, the vogue is to restore all the stuff that's been cut over the years, so that we want to hear the whole Tristan and all the things that Mozart took out of Così fan tutte and so forth. And with new operas, the the absolute panacea is to cut. And since I don't believe the latter, in the case of a musical piece that's good, I find my relationship to the feel of opera right now to be uncomfortable. And I'm looking at a way to worm my way back into the field through the back door, perhaps with a smaller piece, with perhaps more freedom in terms of how I would send it into the world.
And yet, speaking historically, even dealing with composers who are known for operas, save perhaps Wagner, most of them thought musically. I mean, if it's Mozart, if it's Verdi, if it's Puccini, if it's Richard Strauss.
I think we're in a place now where we're going to have to refight the battles of Gluck to try to win back opera from the producers and librettists and directors. Because, in fact, we need to assert that what we're looking for is musical inventions that will want to be heard by many, many audiences. And I don't feel that that is the way that opera is at this moment being perceived. So I feel discouraged when I hear the word opera in the larger sense. In the specific sense, there's nothing I love more than the operas that I think are really great operas. But for my own compositional priorities, I would say I'm not placing a lot of stress on trying at all costs to figure out a way to get back into opera, because my experience with it was, after I finished composing, was not a comfortable ride.
Mm-hmm. Well, critics of Broadway, of musical theater, say the same thing that you've just said about opera, that music is taking a second place to the visuals and to movement.
Yeah, well, we're in a visual age, but that means that, to me, that all the more those of us who work in sound and in time have to be very insistent about what we're doing. At Chicago, when the Gatsby was done, there was a lot of controversy about the last scene, and actually three versions of it were run in a late piano rehearsal. And verdicts were, votes were taken and so forth. But to me, it was all just a dramatic representation of diametrically different viewpoints of what opera is. And my view didn't change. It was just, I'd have to say, tested by a situation like that. But it drew the line so clearly. I was almost grateful for it, though it was not a particularly delightful afternoon.
Well, getting extra performances of an opera is not easy either. I mean, you've had the later production at the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and then it returned to the Met. Mm-hmm. Is there a future life? Are there more performances coming, productions?
It's in a way, I try not to worry too much about that. I think there will be a future life. I think, though, in an intervening stage will be necessary with that piece, which is that it will have to somehow make an appearance either as a recording or as a concert, mm-hmm. as a piece of music, and give people a chance to evaluate it at that level before it will make its way back to the stage, because I think that's the level on which there's a case to be made at this point. So that's what I'm thinking about, but I there's no way to predict. There's no medium where the factors are more diverse as to what guides its return and its survival. I know a lot about opera history, and I know a lot about how various the road has been. I actually am old enough now to have witnessed the trajectory of the Stravinsky Rake's Progress. And I was in Santa Fe as a young composer chosen to hang out with Stravinsky in his first production out there. And at that stage, 1963, that piece was suffering from severe misunderstanding and neglect. And I'd have to say, tracking it as I have, because it's one of the operas in the world that I love the most, it's only in the last decade that there seems to be a consensus that this piece needs to be among us regularly. And it took that long. It took 60 years.
So, I was out there for that production. I saw it.
The Santa Fe.
In Santa Fe.
Yeah. It's a great masterpiece which puzzled so many people in its early guise. Mm-hmm. but it's always what been what it was. And when I saw it a few years ago at the Met, not having seen it for quite a while, what struck me is how trusting he is of his audience and how ambitious he is about what you can put into an operatic score. And
absolutely.
I bless his heart. You know, it's a gift. It's a gift to the audience, but it's a gift which took a long time to be received with great gladness, I think.
Your output includes cantatas and other works of a spiritual nature. For one, you got a Pulitzer, The Flight into Egypt. Your list of selections are from another called Abraham. Can you clue us in on Abraham and on the excerpt we're going to hear?
Yeah, Abraham is one of a series. I like to think of my sacred music as being quite ecumenical in nature. That is to say, I wrote a big piece called Four Psalms for the 50th anniversary of Israel, which was commissioned by the Israeli consulate in Chicago. And I wrote a piece, Samuel, which is a real Old Testament storytelling piece. And, of course, I've written a great many motets, New Testament motets, for our work at Emmanuel Church Boston, and a Requiem, which is, of course, an ancient and rather strange assemblage of texts that have been in the Catholic Church for centuries. And in the case of Abraham, I was asked by a committee in the Vatican with sponsorship from the Knights of Columbus, which is a big American organization, to write a piece for a Vatican Congress on the joining up of the three faiths, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian. And this was to be part of a papal congress in which a number of invited guests were to be conferring about ways towards a more peaceful relationship between the faiths, led by the late Pope. And the idea came up of having a musical, a piece written for that occasion. Mahler Second, the Resurrection Symphony was already on the program. Another good ecumenical text, in a way, can be really read, I think, reasonably comfortably by a number of viewpoints. So as I took on that project, I was immediately attracted to Abraham because he is the figure that all three faiths recognize as a common origin. And I submitted the text, and then it underwent some modification in terms of what portions I would use, and also a decision about which source for the text and which language. And it turned out English was probably the best, and a chorus at the Vatican of members of representatives of the three faiths, a Muslim group from Turkey, the Jewish faith, interestingly enough, represented by the BB Singers from London, a group from Pittsburgh. It was an interesting occasion and a huge audience of about 12,000 people. Pittsburgh Symphony playing, and it's one of the reasons that I used a big brass section for this piece is the Mahler orchestration. And the chorus on that occasion was huge. It was 250 people. So a very specialized kind of commission, but one I was very glad to undertake, and one for which I received kind of instructions from the committee at the Vatican, who responded to others of my motets with indications of sort of thumbs up, thumbs down.
So what are we going to hear?
So we're going to hear just, I guess, the beginning of this motet. It's Abraham... Well, actually, it's very well pronounced. This performance actually is not at the Vatican. This is at Tanglewood, and it is the Boston University Tanglewood Institute. So it's a high school age choir and brass section. Oldest performer is 18, and it's really the message is that Abraham will be the father of many nations.
Thank you.
We have heard a portion of John Harbison's Cantata Abraham, another musical selection that our guest in the studio, Mr. Harbison, asked to be included. This is Profiles. And Mr. Harbison, I should ask you whether when you write orchestral music and or songs and or opera and or spiritual music, sacred music, do you have composer idols who help inspire you? I mean, I realize it's your own muse that has to be at work, but do you take in inspiration from those who came before?
Well, constantly, and I'd have to, of course, mention Stravinsky. We talked about him earlier. He was a very real presence for me when I was growing up. You know, he was, in a sense, he represented the living composer with the most powerful influence and profile that I could think of. And of course, Schoenberg had already died. I remember my father went to hear Schoenberg lecture, came and gave a very vivid account of what he'd heard. And I heard Hindemith play a viola recital when I was growing up. So the great recent figures, European ones, were a reality to me, sometimes a physical reality. And American composers eventually, like Copland and Sessions, were part of my life, actually. And now, thank heaven, Elliot Carter and Milton Babbitt, many senior composers still with us, who are part of, the makers of the American tradition. But really, but the first music that I heard when I was growing up was really Bach. And as it happens, by coincidence, in a way, it was cantata music, because my father played a bunch of organ preludes called the Schubler chorales, all of them in a transcription by Busoni, which used to be very popular. They're all pieces taken from Bach cantatas. And Bach transcribed them for organ, and my father played them on the piano. And the first music I heard really over and over was, say, the Wacht auf chorale prelude, the Tits with the tenor chorale from Cantata 140. Number of cantata pieces that eventually I placed in their context because I became a cantata conductor, all through my life from high school on. So the work with Bach and the thinking about Bach was tremendously important, and it went along with my other great passion of the time, which was jazz and Thelonious Monk and Oscar Peterson and all the piano players. So those two things, really contrapuntal thinking, and improvisation on a given and a strict idea, that is the presence of a pre-existing tune and then the improviser, which seemed to me the subconsciously the unifying thing there between what Monk was doing and what Bach did. And so when I became a cantata conductor already in high school and then on through college and then was music director of cantata singers in Boston for quite a while, it was fitting together. I had sort of left jazz as a profession, but the idea of a strict element, something given that you hopefully know by memory, which would be the chorale, and then an invention around that struck me as being the key musical principle for me, in the one on which I base an awful lot of what I compose. So, and Bach cantata conducting continues to be the one conducting regular connection that I have, and I do 5 or 6 a year at our weekly series at Emanuel Church Boston, which every Sunday morning through the 10 months of the year has been going on for 35 years. And recently I was assigned Cantata 80, which is a piece that I really have known really all my life but never conducted, and about which some controversy had grown up in the scholarly world because for years and years, there was a set of trumpet parts, trumpet and drum parts, and the scholars who brought out the new Bach edition, the august team of scholars, determined that they were not to be played, that they were spurious, they were in the wrong handwriting. And I then studied this piece pretty hard, and I think I brought a composer view to it, or perhaps even a teacher view to it, which is that it mattered to me not a whit that the handwriting was that of Bach's son, Friedman, and not his. That because on an aesthetic level, the trumpet drum part sounded so much better in the piece than out of the piece. And it seemed to me entirely possible that a very busy teacher composer, like Bach was through most of his career, would be glad to assign to such a skilled student the filling in on instruction, the way I actually know that John Williams now does with some of my students out in Hollywood, clearly an important but not absolutely generative aspect of the piece.
Well, so this seems to be a good segue.
I then defiantly, in the face of a few scholars that I knew would be in the audience that week, did the piece with the trumpets back in. And I think, straightened out a couple other scholarly problems. The second movement was always performed with these sort of two weird, almost oriental versions of the chorale, one being sung and the other being played simultaneously. And that, again, my ear were rejected. I thought Bach is not going to suddenly write a heterophony that sounds like it's coming from the Middle East. And my conclusion there, which I think is, you know, I hope a new proposition, is that one is for one set of performances and the other is for another. And you choose one, and then you get something that actually sounds like something Bach might write. So I had the happy experience at Emmanuel of feeling like we'd scored a few scholarly points along with doing, I think, a fairly hot performance of this piece.
So the performance is from where, and what part are we going to hear?
We're going to hear the first chorus, probably the most familiar part of the piece to many people, which embeds the chorale in every part, really, but also most brilliantly in the phenomenal trumpet and bass entrances which end each phrase, each oblong, slightly skewed phrase. And it's just a tremendous, festive, really almost militant version of the Reformation Day chorale that Martin Luther wrote words and music for, and Bach set many times.
And Festbrook. Mm-hmm. And who's performing?
Oh, this is Emmanuel Choir and Orchestra in its regular Cantata Sunday. So you'll hear that group, and then I'm the conductor.
Thank you.
We have just heard the opening chorale from Bach's Cantata No. 80, another choice of our guest in the studio today, John Harbison, who conducted the performance that you have just heard. What joy do you get out of teaching? I know you do a lot of that, too.
Well, you know, when I many years ago, I had a plan not to be teaching, and I worked it all out, and everything worked out, and I got so I was earning a living, didn't need to teach anymore. And at that point, much to my surprise, I decided again, or I realized I didn't want to stop teaching, that there was something there that I missed when I didn't do it for a long period. And I think what it is that there is a certain being drawn out and having to rethink the original premises that I need to do, and I have to almost be forced into. And that's what I do, particularly when I deal sometimes with the less gifted students, though at MIT there are not too many of them. And I also am very privileged and lucky to teach students whose mentality and experience and abilities are totally not congruent with mine, so that I get a kind of an interchange with an entirely other mentality that I wouldn't get from a bunch of other musicians or even a bunch of humanists. And that nourishes me a lot. So I bless the good fortune that plunked me down at MIT in this really quite stimulating and an unusual environment where the person who makes things has a very treasured position, because everybody around there is trying to invent and make something. So that if you happen to be making concert pieces, there are a lot of people get onto the idea that must be good, because if they weren't there before and you have to do it, you're the kind of person we want to have. So that's where I've come down with MIT, and that's probably one of the reasons I'm still teaching.
You sound very happy.
Oh, yeah. You know, that part of my life surprises me over and over. I go in there now with a light step, because I've really realized why I'm not trying to stop.
Tell us one major project of the future.
Well, one major project of the future is to write a sort of narrative piece, a symphonic narrative, which also has one large poem guiding it for a singer and orchestra, which would be perceived somehow as a kind of cross between a symphony and a monodrama. And I'm looking to find just the right subject matter for that. And I want to find a way to write a symphony that has a plot, but in which the plot is more metaphysical than eventful.
This is for Boston?
This is for Mr. Levine and Boston, the greatly revivified and now quite glorious Boston Symphony.
Well, we'll look forward to that, and I'm delighted to meet you. Our guest on Profiles has been composer John Harbison. I thank him, and as today's host, I thank all of you out there for listening. This is Peter Jacoby for Profiles.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in April of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blackland McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.